This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. In just a couple of weeks, President Obama will be sworn into office for a second term. His cabinet's going to get a makeover, and newly elected leaders will populate Cabinet the Hill. On the surface, it looks like D.C. is getting a fresh start. But in reality, will Congress still be influenced by the same interest groups and by the same big money? Joining me to talk about corruption and what it will take to reform things in D.C. is Lawrence Lessig. He's a professor of law at Harvard Law School, and his most recent book is Republic Lost: How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Lawrence Lessig, thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
So I'm just going to start with the news today. We're looking at a government that's seemingly unable to come together to solve this fiscal cliff situation. In your view, does the corroding power of money on politics enter in here?
Yeah, of course it does. We have to step back a bit and recognize what the nature of Congress is right now. This is an institution with an addiction. And the addiction is the drive which members are really forced to undertake to raise money, constantly raise money. There was one recent memo handed out to Democratic freshmen that instructed them that out of their nine-hour day, they were supposed to spend 4 hours raising money, 2 hours in a meet and greet, 2 hours doing congressional work, and 1 hour doing constituent service. So 2 hours of meet and greet and 4 hours of fundraising means 6 out of 9 hours is devoted to the project of raising money to get their party back into power, to get them reelected. So that addiction drives them in one direction. But in the other direction, they're being pushed by their, you know, desire to do the right thing. These are good people, decent people who go to Washington for the right reason. I might not agree with their values, but they're there for the right reason. And the problem is, like anybody with an addiction, the addiction conflicts with what they really want to be doing. So they build an institution that makes it easy to raise money. And that is an institution which is highly polarized, where it's very easy to block any change, where veto is the simplest trigger to pull. That makes it easy to raise money, but it makes it hard to govern. So we now have an ungovernable government, and it's not just the fiscal cliff. It's every major issue that suffers because of this.
So when you talk about the drive for money and how many hours a day congresspeople will spend trying to raise that money, are you saying that essentially – their views are tailored to the people who they are raising money from because, logically, that makes sense for them?
Yeah, no, not on the surface. Mm-hmm. They don't feel like what they're doing is bending to give to the tiny fraction of the 1% who actually give them money. The latest estimate is something like 0.055% of Americans. That's 1/20th of 1% of Americans are the relevant funders of our campaigns, have given even just the maximum to one candidate in a federal election. So they don't feel like they're bending. They don't feel like they're compromising. But when you spend 4 to 6 hours a day on a telephone talking to people you've never met, asking them for money, you can't help but be bent in the direction of the interest of those people whose money you're asking for. And when it's the tiniest fraction of the 1%, who you're raising money from, it is no surprise that you become sensitive to their issues and not so sensitive to the issues that affect the broad swath of Americans.
Okay, well then it seems like you're saying that Republicans in some ways are more vulnerable to this because they are the people who are holding out for tax cuts to also be extended to those who make above $250,000 a year. So is it that Democrats are not spending time on the phone with people making more than $250,000 a year to the same degree that Republicans are?
No, Democrats are, you know, I think Democrats have taken the lead in trying to reform the system, so mm-hmm. I give them credit for that, but they are just as guilty of spending, you know, all of their time raising money as Republicans. So why is it then the Republicans are holding out to benefit the 250,000 plus? I don't think it's so simple as, you know, the rich people are talking to the Republicans on the phone saying, don't raise my taxes. Obviously, the Republican Party is split. There is a far right part of the Republican Party, the Tea Party part of the Republican Party, which has just drawn a line in the sand. They will not raise taxes, period. So you can have a Speaker of the House, John Boehner, who stands up and says, this is what we're going to vote for. But those individual congressmen have to raise their hands or put their card in to vote in the way they want to vote. And if they don't vote to support raising taxes, that's just not going to happen. Now, why is it that we have such an extreme fringe of the Republican Party that is so firm? Well, you know, I've met a bunch of these Tea Partiers. They're you know, good, honest people who believe in what they're doing. But the system plays to them because the more extreme any party is on their own side, the more excited the base gets to support them and to support them with campaign cash. So it pays to be an extremist on both the left and the right.
Although, to play devil's advocate, most people in the Tea Party, I would think, do not make more than $250,000 a year.
Yeah, but they have taken the view that, you know, they also look at the government and say the government is sick. And the only way to solve it is just say, no, not $1 more, period. Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's a catastrophically terrible position to take. I mean, I think our government is, you know, really on the edge. But that's their position. Now, what supports them in being the extremists they are, though, is we've built a system for funding campaigns where we have to play to the extremes if we're going to get all the money we need for both parties to run their campaigns.
You know, it's interesting. You talk in the book about how this is not really just a political issue, this idea of money invading, you know, politics, but it could be anything. And so I was looking at the degree to which you say, you know, money is important in other areas, too. You talk about cell phone studies, which I thought was really interesting. So the question of when you hold a cell phone up to your ear for an hour, 2, 3 hours, 30 minutes, whatever it is a day, does that affect you? And you have this statistic of, okay, studies that were funded by the cell phone companies, the industry, and studies that weren't. And the ones that were funded by the industry found that 28% of them found no effect on, or rather that there is an effect on people. 72% found that there weren't. So if they're funded by the industry, they find that mostly, no, there's no effect on you. If they are independently funded, 67% of them found there is a biological effect. 33% found there's no biological effect. So essentially, if your study is funded by the industry, the percentage chance that you're going to say cell phones are fine for you is much, much higher.
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, the point that I'm making in this part of the book is to say we need to depend on institutions and we need to depend on to be able to trust them. And it's just a fact about us that if I tell you something like what you just reported, that, you know, a correlation between industry funding and finding no problem with cell phones is extremely high.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with the chemical BPA. It's exactly the same kind of pattern. We can't help but now be more skeptical about cell phones. You know, I'm not a scientist. I'm not going to tell you cell phones are dangerous, although I will tell you I don't want my children to have them next to their head. But that's not my claim. My claim is the fact that you now know this correlation exists makes you more skeptical about the industry when it says, yeah, cell phones are fine. And it's the same point about government. When you learn that congressmen are spending 30 to 70% of their time raising money, and not raising money from all of us, raising money from the tiniest fraction of the 1% of us, you can't help but now be much more skeptical about whether they're actually acting in the interest of all of us versus acting in the interest of the tiniest fraction of the 1%. Now, what's the response in both cases? The response is just to find a different way to fund the enterprise, so that we're not cynical about the outcome of this enterprise. We could fund elections differently, and you would still not like what Congress does, you know, a bunch of the time, but you wouldn't think they're doing what they're doing because of the money. And the same thing with research about, you know, something as important as whether cell phones are causing cancer. You know, we ought to be able to do this in a way that people believe that the scientists are saying what's true, as opposed to what happens to help make it easier to fund the research the scientists are engaged
in. And I want to get to that point of how do you create a new system, but I just stay with the cell phone example for a minute. When you hear research that says, for example, walnuts are great for you, do you wonder, has this kind of money infiltrated so many areas that you start to wonder, what if this is the Walnut Association of California that funded this study?
Yeah, no, I think it's a good thing to wonder about. You know, Michael Pollans has a wonderful passage in one of his books about if you walk down the aisles of a grocery store and you look at the advertising claiming health benefits and you look at the stuff that has no advertising claiming health benefits, there's an inverse relationship between the advertising and the health benefits. So, you know, all the, you know, high whole wheat, cereals and all this sort of stuff, not really that healthy, but beets. You know, beets are really healthy, but there's no advertising for beets. There's only advertising for the cereals. Now, this is because, you know, it's just a way the market system works. And I'm not, you know, you can't just throw out the market system. Nobody would want to do that. But we do have to think about, we have to be more critical about what's the reason why we're being told something. And when we can see there's such a tight link between the interest and the reason, then I think, you know, we need institutions we can count on who are not dependent upon that same kind of interest to tell us what's true. You know, so we should be able to rely on scientists to tell us what's true, not tell us what happens to make it easier for them to fund their budgets to do research. And that's a big problem that not just affects Congress, but affects, you know, a wide range of institutions.
Right, exactly. I mean, you even talk about doctors, which we have seen in the news recently, who maybe on the side are giving speeches for a certain company, and they also prescribe the medicine that's created by that company. These are inherent problems.
That's right. And at Harvard, I run a center, the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics, and we have a lab that's studying what we think of as institutional corruption, which is, you know, in each of these institutions, you know, the academy, you know, academics taking money to give public testimony, medicine, the financial services industry, auditors. These are all areas where if you look at it, you increasingly recognize the way in which money has been allowed into the mix in a way that at least leads ordinary people to wonder, is it the truth you're giving me or is it the answer that helps your bottom line? And that is enough reason to worry about the way we're funding it. And then the second step is not just our perception. It's in fact the case that in a lot of these areas, the actual things being said are being affected by the money. You know, I know in my own field, when I was doing work in telecommunications, I really got thinking about this issue when I was testifying once about network neutrality. And one of the senators, Senator Sununu, texted me and he said, "You should not be shilling for these big internet companies." And I was kind of shocked because I thought, oh my God, he thinks I'm being paid to give this testimony. And then I thought, of course he thinks I'm being paid because everybody in my field now is being paid to give testimony. Right. So when you stand up and you say, I'm a professor from Harvard, people are thinking, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. But who's actually writing the check for you to be here? And I think that's outrageous. You know, I think that if you want to be somebody testifying as a professor from Harvard, that should be it. You shouldn't be also taking money from the interests that you're testifying about. And that's the basic instinct. It's not so complicated that I think all of us have in our gut when we think about these institutions we need to rely upon and trust. And the most important right now, I think, is our government. We've got to be able to have confidence in our government. And if we think that our government is constantly just bending towards the direction of the funders that make it easy to fund their campaigns, then we're not going to have that level of trust.
Okay, so that brings us to how do you come up with the sort of new and innovative way of thinking about how you recreate a system that right now, as you say, is somewhat corrupted. And I want to just play a clip from former lobbyist Jack Abramoff, you talk a little bit about in the book. Here he is talking with Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes about one way that his office, which was trying to raise money mostly for Native American casinos, tried to woo senators.
When we would become friendly with an office and they were important to us and the chief of staff was a competent person, I would say, or my staff would say to him or her at some point, you know, when you're done working on the Hill, we'd very much like you to consider coming to work for us. Now, the moment I said that to them or any of our staff said that to them, that was it. We owned them. And what does that mean? Every request from our office, every request of our clients, everything that we want, they're going to do. And not only that, they're going to think of things we can't think of.
Lawrence Lessig from Harvard. You know, here's Jack Abramoff saying these people then become so entrepreneurial, they think, I have an idea for you. You probably haven't thought of it yet. So, you know, how do you put enough restrictions on a senator that the people associated with that person then in the future can't get jobs somewhere else? How can you restrict people that much?
Well, so Jack has become a very big reformer. And I have enormous respect for the work that he's doing. And he's given us a lot of insights about the way in which D.C. works. And those insights really show the truth behind something I quote in my book that Jim Cooper, who was a congressman from Tennessee, a Democrat who's been in Congress for as long as about 20 other members of Congress, Jim Cooper once said to me, you know, the problem with Capitol Hill is that Capitol Hill has become a kind of farm league for K Street, where the lobbyists work. And so what he's saying is members and staffers and bureaucrats all have this common business model. And the business model is focused on their life after government, their life as lobbyists. So Public Citizen calculates between 1998 and 2004, 50% of the Senate, 42% of the House left to become lobbyists. Those numbers have only gone up. And as United Republic calculated last spring, for the members that they tracked, the average salary increase for members going was 1,452%. So here you have members who are thinking, okay, I'm getting what, you know, most Americans would think of a lot of money, but they think it's chump change, a couple hundred thousand dollars to be a congressman. But I can make it to the big league. The big league would be a lobbyist like Jack Abramoff.
Well, recently we heard that Representative Joanne Emerson from Missouri, who just won a 10th term in Congress, right? November 2012, can't get much more recent than that, said she's going to be head of a lobbying group instead. So instead of making $170,000 a year, she's going to be making in the neighborhood of $1.5 million
right.
a year.
Yeah. So the members of Congress is one layer. But I think that the seedier layer, the one that's really, really dangerous, is the staffer layer. Because staffers increasingly are the sort of people who are thinking, how do I go from the staff to becoming a lobbyist? And you talk to staffers and they talk about the kind of chumps, the people who don't leave when they need to leave, like to maximize their money as they become a lobbyist. So when you begin to think of this whole system that is focused on how they can become lobbyists, you begin to understand why the lobbyists are enormously powerful. And, you know, Jack Abramoff is not an exception. He is just, you know, the most successful of all the lobbyists. All the other ones are playing the same game. But that game is a game where it's relatively obvious the way in which lobbyists can basically sell the ability to affect government policy to their clients. It's very lucrative for their clients to buy that policy, and it's very easy for members to comply with the lobbyists because that's the way the members can actually raise the money they need to get back into Congress.
So how do you create the restrictions? Because it's as you said, it's not just members of Congress. It's really not even just their staffers. Tom Daschle, the former Senate Majority Leader, his wife has been an advocate and lobbyist for the airline industry. Clarence Thomas, who rolls, as you know, on the Supreme Court, his wife has worked for a lot of advocacy groups. So, I mean, how do you say, you know, your brother-in-law and your daughter and, you know, all these people who, frankly, can really cash in, even if they have a father who's only making so much money, they can enrich the family in other ways. How do you do that?
Yeah. So there are two strategies. One strategy is the one we've tried for the last 40 years, which is basically let's add restriction to restriction to restriction to restriction. And what that strategy has done is basically create lots of incentives to innovate and find ways around the restrictions. And my view is it's never going to be enough to talk about restrictions. What we have to do is we have to change the basic incentives of the system. So the reason lobbyists are so powerful, the reason they have the opportunity to pay themselves millions of dollars and to hire members and staffers for the money, is because they play an essential role. And the essential role is channeling money into political campaigns. If you eliminated that role, you wouldn't eliminate lobbyists. There's always going to be lobbyists. But you wouldn't have lobbyists who are so valuable to the system that they could afford to pay their partners millions of dollars to be lobbyists. Instead, they would be policy wonks. You know, they'd be paid $100,000, $70,000, whatever, but they wouldn't be paid millions and millions of dollars. So you've got to remove them from this essential role that they play in funding campaigns. So how do you do that? Well, the only way to do that is to change fundamentally the way we fund campaigns. So, you know, we have a system where the tiniest fraction of the 1% fund campaigns. We've got to move to a system where most of us, all of us, are basically participating in funding campaigns. You know, all of us, in theory, are supposed to participate in voting That's twice every election cycle, the primary and the general election. Those two discrete moments, everybody has a role to play. We also have a continuous election, though. It's the fundraising election. And in that election, too, we have to have a system where all of us can play so that they don't spend all of their time focused on, you know, 140,000 Americans, so that the lobbyists don't have such an enormous ability to channel money and become so essential to these addicts. You know, these are the suppliers for the addicts. These are the pushers for the addicts. Mm-hmm. And no surprise that these suppliers have the power they have given the way that we've created this particular addiction inside the system.
I want to ask you how likely that is to happen. And I'm also interested in where other countries are on this spectrum of public funding of campaigns. Are we alone? Are we with everybody else? We're talking about what it will take to end government corruption with a focus on Congress. I'm speaking with Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig, whose most recent book is Republic Lost: How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. I'm Kara Miller, and the conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH. This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. If you're just joining us, we're talking about what it will take to end corruption on Capitol Hill. And here with me in Studio 3 is Lawrence Lessig, a professor of law at Harvard Law School. And his most recent book is Republic Lost: How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Okay, let's talk about that plan. And, you know, obviously, lobbying is a huge business. Those people are not interested in being put out of business. So how do you start moving forward this idea of publicly funding campaigns?
Well, yeah, let's be clear. We have not had a more difficult political challenge in this country in maybe 50 years with the civil rights challenge, maybe in 100 years since we fought the corruption of the Gilded Age. This will take an enormously powerful movement. And the movement has got to come from outside the Beltway. People inside the Beltway will not want this movement to succeed because they depend upon this system. That's their future. That's their retirement. So these are not our allies. Of course, there are particular people in D.C. who I think we can count on. You know, I think we sent Elizabeth Warren to Washington. She will be on our side in this fight. But the longer people are there, the more they and their family depend upon this system surviving. So we need a grassroots outside the Beltway movement that begins to raise the obvious answer, the obvious solution to this problem as common sense, as this thing that everybody recognizes we have to do to fix this problem. And the only way to fix this problem, in my view, is to make all of us funders of elections. So what does that mean? It doesn't mean what we traditionally think of as public funding. I'm not imagining the federal government writes a check for $1 million to a candidate to run his or her campaign. Instead, all of us should be given, let's think of it as like a voucher or a coupon for an amount of money we can give to candidates to help them fund their campaigns. So, you know, in my book, I talk about a $50 voucher, which would produce three times the amount of money which was raised and spent in the 2010 campaign by members of Congress. So that's a lot of money. But all of us would have this $50 voucher that we could give to a candidate if that candidate agrees to fund his or her campaign with vouchers only. Now, if that were the system and candidates were focused not on the tiniest fraction of the 1%, but on all of us to raise their money, then they would not be so beholden, so captured, so controllable by this tiny fraction of the 1%. Now, this idea of funding with something like vouchers or small dollar contributions is beginning to take off across the country. There are three states now, Arizona, Maine, and Connecticut, that have basically small dollar matching systems for funding their elections. Arizona is now talking about adding a voucher component to it. Congressman John Sarbanes, who's a Democrat from Maryland, he's the son of Paul Sarbanes. John Sarbanes has introduced a bill called the Grassroots Democracy Act that has a matching fund system for small dollar contributions. You know, you give $100, it gets matched 5 to 1 or 10 to 1. It has a tax credit proposal where you get to deduct $100, get a $100 tax credit for small contributions. It also has a voucher component, it's a pilot program for this idea of vouchers. But that, too, is a system that would fund elections through small contributions only.
But aren't we dependent here on those kinds of bills getting through a House and a Senate that, frankly, is doing pretty well without them? I mean, they get to go on trips that lobbyists fund. I mean, Jack Abramoff talks about how he just bought the best tickets to every sporting event, and congresspeople are able to go and their families and their favorite people from their districts. It seems like I can't imagine it getting through Congress.
It's going to take an enormous fight, and it's going to take leaders who are interested in rallying this outside the Beltway grassroots movement. And it's got to be cross-partisan. And, you know, I work really hard in my book to demonstrate that this is not an issue that should concern just the left. It's an issue that has to concern the left and the right. The right lose just as much as the left loses because of this system. And so we've got to build something that we have not built, I think, in 100 years. The progressive movement, which we think of as a liberal movement, but the progressives were conservatives and liberals who got together to try to change the corrupt system of government that existed 100 years ago. We need a new kind of progressive movement that's not a bunch of politicians, not people who want to become politicians, but kind of citizens who stand up and say, how are we going to pull together the power we need to finally say to Washington, enough, enough. Now, if you go to a site called represent.us, represent.us, there's a really fantastic bill called the American Anti-Corruption Act, which I think is the most ambitious reform that has been proposed in 100 years. Jack Abramoff helped construct part of it. Stephen Colbert's lawyer, Trevor Potter,
yes,
has been the author of this bill. This bill would be the most important change we've seen in 100 years. And what they're doing is they're going out to citizens and they're saying, we want 1 million citizen co-sponsors first. And when we get 1 million citizens co-sponsors, then we're going to turn around and go back to Washington and say, we got 1 million citizens behind this bill. Now we want you to pass it. Now, you know, I'm not naive to think this is an easy fight. This is not like, you know, I actually think gun control legislation is going to be 1 million times easier to get through than this, because it really takes people to think, to recognize how every issue they care about is being blocked by the money. And it's going to take an education campaign to get them there. But I do think people are right now at the position where they really recognize this system is corrupted. You know, the number two most important issue Gallup found when they polled Americans in July about what the next president should deal with, number two on that list, only higher one was jobs, was corruption in Washington. Corruption in Washington. And by corruption, it's the first time this was on that list in that place. By corruption, nobody was thinking about Jack Abramoff. They weren't thinking about, you know, old-style corruption. They were thinking about money and politics. That's the issue everybody's talking about. So right now, we've got an American public who recognizes this is an issue. Now we need leaders, both outside the Beltway and inside the Beltway, who say, finally, this is enough. We're going to fix this system, and we're going to build a movement that tries to fix this system.
And yet people do very often dislike Congress, but like their own congressperson. All right, let's situate
this. Can I just correct
that?
That was true, but it's no longer true. They don't like their own congressperson either. So that the pessimism has grown to such a level that, you know, Congress has a confidence level hovering around 10%. People's hatred of Congress in general is very high, but their dissatisfaction with their own member has fallen too. So now everybody should have an interest in fixing the system, but the question is, will anybody have the courage to stand up and do something about
mm-hmm.
it?
So where do we stand, the U.S., in terms of other countries? Do other countries have just as corrupt a system? Are there countries that are doing it better?
So the kind of corruption I'm talking about is legal corruption. It's not illegal corruption. Indeed, I think illegal corruption, bribery, that kind of stuff in the United States Congress is as low as it's ever been. You know, that institution is extremely clean when you think about illegal corruption. It's legal corruption that they're guilty of. And when you look across the world, different countries have different kinds of corruption problems. So many countries, I think, have plenty illegal corruption, bribery in the old traditional sense. But many more, especially in Europe, are, you know, you could say maturing to be much more of the kind of legal corruption that I'm talking about. But the big difference between the United States and the rest of the world is the United States has a very strict First Amendment free speech clause that has been interpreted in a way that restricts the ability of the government to deal with this issue in any of the ways that other countries around the world deal with this issue. So, for example,
the idea that money is speech.
Yeah, money is speech, and you can't limit expenditures by independent candidates' contributions. So around the world, for example, in equivalent democracies, public funding of elections is the norm. It's just the norm. It's just the way it's done. Televisions are, you know, in some countries like France, you can't have television ads at all. No television ads. The only television you get are chunks of time given to the party in like 30-minute blocks where they can lay their platform out for everybody to see. You couldn't do that in the United States, consistent with our First Amendment. You have elections that are just a couple months around the time when the election is called. That's because those are parliamentary systems where there's no fixed calendar for the election, so nobody runs until an election is actually called. But in our system, you know the election's going to be in 2 years. So right now, it has already begun. There are people already in New Hampshire for 2016 beginning to talk to build the... But you couldn't change that in our system without changing our Constitution and without changing the way the First Amendment limits. So the First Amendment makes it really hard for us to solve this problem in the way that other countries around the world have solved it. Most haven't solved it, like corruption is an international problem. But there have been a lot of equivalent kind of democracies that have. The Scandinavian countries have extremely low corruption index. They have very responsive government to the interests of the people. And they have members that, don't spend their time raising money. I spoke in Sweden at the Swedish parliament and went to dinner with a bunch of parliamentarians. And one guy just said to me, I don't understand this at all. I've been in parliament for 6 years. I have never once asked anybody for money. Never once. I don't understand how you even think as a member of parliament if you're thinking constantly about raising money. So it is so much the norm for us. We don't even recognize how crazy our system is. And people around the world look at our system. They can't imagine how we call ourselves a democracy, because who are they responsive to? Are they responsive to all of us, or are they responsive to the tiniest fraction, the 1/20th of the 1% who are funding our elections?
You talked before about how this kind of illegal corruption has an effect on both left and right. And I want to talk in our last couple minutes here about a couple of areas in which you say that you can really see the effect of money. One is this question of why aren't our schools better? And you essentially say, look, in the mid-1970s, and our schools weren't super great in the mid-1970s, we were at a certain level. We were very, very high in the OECD countries. Now we're 14th in reading, 25th in math, 17th in science. Why? And what does money have to do with us not being able to fix schools?
Yeah. So you're going to get me in trouble, because the book is really structured to sort of pick on Republicans and pick on Democrats both. Now you're hitting me on the Democratic side, and so my Democratic friends are going to be angry. But okay, here it goes. What we know about schools is that it's an extremely complicated problem. There are a lot of hardworking people, hardworking teachers, administrators who are trying to make it better, but it's extremely complicated. So what we need is the chance to innovate, to be experimental in this space. But the political parties are so tied with the vested interests of our current system, including teachers' unions, that they don't want that kind of innovation, especially if it threatens their financial base. So the Democratic Party is deeply dependent upon the teachers' unions to fund them. And whenever you raise the question of innovation that challenges the position of teachers' union, I'm sure, right now this conversation itself will raise outrage and craziness from people in the Democratic Party that nobody should ever be thinking about this. But one reason we should be skeptical of that, passion is tied to the enormous financial benefit which these unions put into the system. Now, they might be right on the merits. I'm not saying they're wrong on the merits. What I'm saying is we need a system where when I see the Democratic Party taking the position the Democratic Party takes, I believe they're taking it for the right reason and not for the money. So in this is a simple, obvious case of where it's hard to believe they're taking it for the right reason when there's so much money on the table.
Well, and you talk, too, about sort of looking at the data and eliminating certain reasons that schools are not good. For example, the number of kids in the classroom. And what you really say is it's about good teachers. That is, good education is very much about good teachers, which may involve paying them a lot.
Yeah.
And it may also involve not having teacher tenure.
It certainly, it's hard for me as a tenured professor to say this, and I'm totally happy to even think about tenure at the university level too. But this has got to be a question which we answer based on what's the right answer, not on what's the most powerful check writing capacity for one side in the answer in the debate or the other. And so, yeah, teachers are one obvious case. You know, sugar subsidies inside of our political system, which subsidizes the price of sugar and by tariffs that block competing sugar companies and lowers the cost of high fructose corn syrup by subsidizing the production of corn. That's another way in which, you know, we mess up our diet by putting all of this terrible food into the mix because of the way government policy is being driven, and it's being driven again because of the way these elections are funded. There's a whole slew of these cases where when you read this section of the book, I think you walk away and you just think, I can't trust anything they do. I can't trust anything they do because what the book does is say, here's an example. You tell me whether you think this makes sense. The answer is doesn't seem to make sense. And then I tell you, well, here's all the money on the table that seems to correlate with the crazy answer that we've gotten. And then you walk away from this and you think, well, I just can't believe the government is doing what it's doing for the right reason as opposed to what produces the most cash.
When you talk about sugar and corn syrup, it's interesting because it seems like the financial cost, for example, of obesity is real. It's very, huge. Very high. So if we care about money, why don't we care about, okay, well, if we do this, which the sugar industry is going to love and the corn industry is going to love and the soy industry is going to love and whatever, if we do those things, there is a cost on the other side. And that's costing us a heck of a lot, too, and brings us back to the whole fiscal cliff issue we were talking about at the beginning, Medicare, Medicaid, all that.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, what I'm talking about is not to be against policies that make the nation wealthy. I want the nation to be wealthy. What I'm talking about are policies that make particular special interests wealthy at the expense of the rest of us. So when we have tariffs that block sugar imports to benefit the sugar barons of the United States, that makes no sense at all, especially when it drives us to consume high fructose corn syrup, which is subsidized in the United States because of subsidy of corn production in the United States. That makes no sense at all. It makes sense for the industries that have lobbied for this, the sugar barons and the ADMs of the world who want subsidies for corn in a million different ways. Those guys make a bundle because of this current system. But the rest of us lose. And that's the dynamic. You know, you can go from Wall Street to the agricultural industry, to the way we run our school systems, to global warming, you know, climate change issues. All of these are cases where there are clear winners. Those clear winners spend their money to make sure that they protect themselves against reforms that actually stop us, the American people, from being the losers. Because in all of these cases, we've become the losers.
So, and in the case of Medicare and Medicaid, which are probably the losers because they have to deal with rising obesity, they don't have a cadre of lobbyists on K Street.
No, of course they don't.
Yeah.
Nothing to compare.
We've been talking about how money corrupts Congress and what it might take to put an end to that corruption. And I've been speaking with Lawrence Lessig, a professor at Harvard Law School. Lawrence Lessig, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks. So the world didn't end last week, but could it feel like the apocalypse for coffee lovers? We will look at how climate change could affect the cost of your cup of coffee. I'm Kara Miller, and you're listening to Boston Public Radio.